Welcome to My PT Podcast, the podcast dedicated to providing insight and encouragement to the rehabilitation community. I am your host, Devin DeBoer, physical therapist, and today I am joined by Leonard Van Gelder. He is a physical therapist, private practice owner. Practice name is Dynamic Movement and Recovery. And he's also has a continuing education piece called Dynamic Principles that he's starting to develop and promote. Welcome to the podcast, Leonard.
Thank you for having me, Doug.
Why don't you just start out by who you are and where you've been in the physical therapy world and start there.
So it's been kind of an interesting process. So I have actually as a physical therapist has been kind of a shorter part of my history than the rest of it. I started kind of this process roughly in 2003, 2004. So I had been involved in martial arts. I'd been involved in I'd been actually quite strongly involved in traditional Chinese medicine back in the day before I had a little bit of a science background. Anyway, long story short is during that process of both being a martial artist and a teacher and kind of getting more and more involved with teaching movement beyond just mm-hmm. my martial arts skills, mm-hmm. I had a number of injuries. I'd been involved in kind of stunt acrobatic performance, and I'd been involved in other aspects of martial arts. And so I started to have more and more kind of musculoskeletal issues that were going on, and had some good exposure to physical therapists who were both manual therapy and exercise oriented. And so it was my first exposure to it. Kind of created this idea that maybe somehow I will become a personal trainer and a massage therapist. I had this weird I was in a denial to some degree. I was like I don't want to go back to school because I was actually I had this issue with academics. I was a high school dropout and I had a first career and I just didn't see myself going back to school. So I was in denial for a good year and a half between 2002-2003 before I actually went to a conference for personal trainers, and there was a event speaker there, and he made the statement that I'd learned more from physical therapists than I had from anyone else. And at that point in time, the next day I called Grand Valley and I'm like, okay, how do I do this?
That's a huge step, man. So, that's amazing. How old were you at the time?
At the time, it would have been 22, 23. So I was, again, it was kind of a later start. I dropped out of high school about 16, 17. And so, yeah, it was a ways out.
Wow. From high school dropout to PT student.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah, and there was nothing easy about that journey. I'll tell you that much. There was a lot of trying to get over some internal demons and egos regarding learning and
school
and
in general.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
To learn.
Well, just through your martial arts and your desire to learn more. You were a learner.
Yeah, I just
maybe
didn't realize that.
Maybe not in a traditional sense.
Yeah. I was
starting that yourself, you know?
Oh,
yeah. Interesting. Maybe you just needed your own motivation.
Yeah.
Somebody else telling you what to do. You needed that motivation to find that, to find out what you wanted to study.
Exactly.
Instead of, you need to study geography and biology, but you didn't know the purpose of it.
Correct. That's exactly right.
I have a son that's very similar. Highly difficult for him to learn something if he's not motivated about it.
Yeah.
What's the purpose for the whole thing?
Yeah.
Why? You know? I'm like, it'll come. Just wait. But, wow. Cool. What a courageous move.
Yeah, it was. It's always interesting. Every time I try and revisit or talk about the story, I'm still trying to process to some degree. But you're right. It was really just a degree of realizing... for one thing, I was always learning, and I was always self-taught. You know, I had a first career in IT, and was, get the background in martial arts as well. And so I had this drive to learn. But again, it was if I didn't know why or mm-hmm. what the purpose was, I couldn't.
Yeah.
Couldn't drive.
So Grand Valley.
Yeah.
And that was, you started that 2003?
Yeah. So basically, what it was I since I had no high school equivalent, I had no GED, no nothing. I asked them, so what do I do? And so they said, well, you have two options. One is you get your GED and you can start courses here as a non-degree seeking student, or you can go to GRCC and take what's called an ACCUPLACER. ACCUPLACER allows you to kind of identify your strengths and weaknesses and from an academic perspective. And anything that you lacked in, you would just take some basically non-college courses.
Okay.
So I ended up doing well in everything except for math, which was always a challenge for me. And so did that piece and completed the courses that I needed for it and became a degree-seeking student without any high school equivalent.
Wow.
So
cool.
So that was huge because I think it was what I needed. I needed that opportunity because I think that if I couldn't do it my way to some degree,
yeah.
If I had to follow some of these things, it would have been a little bit harder.
Sure.
So I worked through, did a lot of my prereqs at GRCC as well, sure. as did the associates there just because I started to get a little bit more interested in the scientific method and mm-hmm. Being able to access electronic journals and actually read literature was interesting. And
yes.
So it took my time a little bit at the start.
Mm-hmm.
And so my first thoughts were, you know, to, at the time it was still the master's. It was not yet transitioned mm-hmm. over to the doctorate.
Mm-hmm.
And so my first thought was, okay, as I'm going through this process, learning how to learn and learning how to do these things was, I'm going to do clinical exercise science as my undergrad. But then as I started to learn a little bit more about athletic training, I realized, you know what, if I'm going to do this and I want to become a movement and a pain specialist, I want to see the full spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
And so I ended up adding the second degree and did athletic training as well.
Oh, okay.
And so that was actually another layer of learning. And
through Grand Valley?
Correct, yeah.
Okay.
So okay. It was a process and a challenge, and it was learning to do. It was good preparation because it was, you would be long hours doing your clinical rotations, plus you'd be expected to do 12 plus credit units. And so
yes.
I think I learned a lot in the process of the athletic training beyond orthopedics. There was mm-hmm. a lot that I learned, again, skill development wise.
Sure, yeah. And you're with patients.
Exactly. Yeah, so cool. Right from the get-go, you were...
Do I like this or not?
Yeah, exactly. You were able to get exposure immediately. And
yes.
Some of the rotations were in the hospital and primary outpatient.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And so it really kind of gave me that ability to, in addition to what I was already kind of dabbling on the side with, you know, family, friends, and, mm-hmm. you know, different individuals, I was able to get a little clinical exposure earlier.
Sure.
And
yeah.
that kept growing mm-hmm. through the process of becoming an athletic trainer.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally applying to Grand Valley. And at that point in time, it had transitioned to the doctoral
okay.
program.
Right.
So that was, okay, all right. So now we have one more year
yeah, <right.
laughs> to go through this process.
Yes, yeah.
Which is good because then, you know, again, you're done. You know, you're at your terminal degree for an entry
yes.
for an entry yeah. level program.
Yeah.
During that process, as I mentioned, you know, once I was introduced to being able to access literature electronically, again, that mm-hmm. kind of piqued part of me that was part of my IT history, knowledge,
sure.
and
yep.
managing lots of information.
Mm-hmm.
And so during undergrad, I actually did my first clinical research study.
Okay.
And so that was actually published, I think, right before I finished my undergrad. So I published my first peer review article.
Wow. So impressive.
From non-student, non-academic,
to academic producing.
Exactly. It was,
wow.
It was a bit of a... It was interesting, and but so I went through that process, and that taught me a lot because it taught me to question the literature and to follow what I call follow the rabbit hole, which is when a conclusion is made by an author, sometimes their conclusions don't match the results,
mm-hmm.
as well as sometimes how they reference another author is not very accurate. I had to
mm-hmm.
sometimes actually make phone calls to try to track down researchers and identify, okay, was this the intent of what you meant? And so I think that developed in the level of critical thinking and questioning
mm-hmm.
that I wouldn't have had otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
Got into Grand Valley and...
Is that the only school you applied to?
No, I applied to one other one. I applied to Oakland. So
okay.
I was very fortunate to,
yes.
as well.
Like,
to,
oh my.
Yeah, because it is obviously very competitive and continues
yes.
to grow every,
yeah,
every
very
year.
Competitive. Yeah,
yeah.
Wow.
So, which is, again, it was surprising because I was academic flunk out in high school, and to be able to achieve was, yeah, pretty...
It says a lot about your character, though. I mean, I think that's huge that if I was looking to bring somebody in, you have life experiences that other people don't have, and you're going to really appreciate the chance to learn,
yeah.
you know, as a second career. Yeah. You know, you're not going to just take it as, oh, I deserve this, or I'm entitled to this, you know. You have the opposite. You're like, I get the opportunity to do
this. It was huge, yeah.
That's sweet. That's cool.
I felt very fortunate. Every step of the way, I feel like it was truly, I mean, the chances and the opportunities were just tremendous blessings, because you just, exactly like you're saying, you these things aren't just there.
No.
They're just like, you have to know their value, and you have to
yes.
know their meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can be there at the right moment in the time and, mm-hmm. and show that you really
yes.
care about it,
okay.
then that's where it comes.
So then you graduated, and first job after that was where?
So I worked with Generation Care, and
okay.
So for 5 years I've worked with Generation Care, and phenomenal company. Was able to develop and grow and learn so many things.
Outpatient then?
Outpatient.
Okay.
So, yes,
all right.
it was all outpatient,
mm-hmm.
Primarily orthopedics. Up to that point, I had even my last, probably the second and third year of physical therapy school, I started to again follow literature regarding pain, and starting
okay.
to question some of my beliefs regarding what I held to be true about certain things with biomechanics and
mm-hmm.
and with pain. And as I came into working at Generation Care, there was already a large part of me that was ready to start really evolving even my own beliefs of my own pain and with my patients and with previous cases over the years prior. I started to really think through the things that even when I was successful, why was it successful? And sometimes I started to wonder, it was not because of the reason that I thought that I was.
Wasn't the biomechanical reason?
You got it, exactly. It wasn't because of those reasons. And I kept questioning and started to get connected with more and more clinicians through multiple networks, and social media started to be very. It was much more accessible in terms of some of the literature and some of the voices and
mm-hmm.
Following some of the individuals. Unfortunately, right around that time, one of the really influential individuals, Louis Gifford, passed away right at my graduation year from cancer.
Okay.
And so I never had a chance to meet him. I would have loved to have
okay.
had a chance to meet him. But
was he a researcher? Was he a
physical therapist
okay.
Out of England. And,
okay.
He had done some tremendous things. He introduced something called the mature organism model, and it was based on another project called the Neuromatrix, which was, if you think about gate control theory, which most everyone is familiar
mm-hmm.
with,
mm-hmm.
Ronald Melzack and Patrick Wall, they had obviously it was about 65 that they had published their work related to gate theory.
Okay.
3 years later, they published their work on the Neuromatrix. However, that has not made it as most people. Most people have not had that that background, and Louis really kind of expanded on that.
Okay.
And there's been some things that are predictive processing and some other things that have grown since that time.
Okay.
And the idea was, this was a little bit. I mean, there's no clear cut way to say that all of the processing and all the physiology and biology that we understand in the biopsychosocial model, they're not all, you cannot cleanly put them in a box, but it gave us a little bit of a framework that we didn't have before. And I think it was helpful for me clinically, as well as from how do I talk to people about it, to get exposed to that, get in the clinic, start to think, how does this work? And then the next step was mentoring or having a mentor like Adrian Lowe was huge, connecting and going to some of his courses and
okay.
Going through the therapeutic pain specialty. I was one of the first 22 of us that went through the program.
Oh, cool. That was through what?
Adrian Lowe's, he has an International Spine and Pain Institute.
Oh, cool. Where was that out of?
It was, at the time, it was a split between Story City, Iowa and Denver, Colorado.
Okay.
But they have, with each cohort, it's varying places. I think it's primarily in Denver right now.
Okay.
That they're doing that. But since we were sort of like the guinea pigs,
okay.
We were a little bit split between...
Was that a week-long course?
Or was it, it was a six-month process. Wow. So a large portion of it was online and
okay.
then 2 weekend intensives.
Okay. Friday, Saturday, Sunday?
It was Saturday, Sunday.
Saturday, Sunday. Okay. All right. Do you have a testing, like a...
Yep, it was, there's testing along the way. So okay. as well as at the end, there was a final project essentially that was,
okay.
that was completed for that. So,
oh, wow. Cool.
So that was really...
accomplishment.
Yeah, it was really... I think that was a good... I think it was a good rounding of my base.
Okay.
Was at that
point. And that was when you were at Generation Care?
Yes, correct, yeah.
And then that was... How long after you graduated?
That was probably I started the process, I think, 2 years after I graduated.
Okay.
1.5, 2 years afterwards. And then
right.
And then the third year, what we did is I worked with Generation Care. We created basically a pain specialty division.
Oh, okay.
And so it was kind of our first dabble of, like, how do we try in a company that's larger to figure out a way to... How do we figure out a way that we can identify individuals who want to take on more complex cases,
okay.
and are willing to dig deeper for dealing with the larger layers of not just what we know previously, but get into some
mm-hmm.
of the psychosocial elements and how that integrates
okay.
into the biology and the physiology. And so we started this, and it really did well, particular with our Grand Rapids office. We did... It was exceptionally well. I mean, the clinic
okay.
was quite successful based off of the
cool.
pain referral base for that. And through all the locations, we had individuals who progressed through that process. And
mm-hmm.
so it was a really good experience to kind of experiment with bringing together ideas and
mm-hmm.
having individuals trial and see how things went. You know, if some
mm-hmm.
things went well, some things did not went well.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that we developed a good system, especially for kind of the first attempt of this, where we would almost kind of tier individuals. Everyone would have some idea of recognizing flags that would be indication like this is probably not going to do as well in a traditional
so you kind of steered those patients.
You got it, exactly.
Oh, okay. All right.
And then direct them to the individuals
okay.
who could.
Okay.
So that was really fun and exciting, and I'm very, very thankful to Holly and Generation Care to have had that opportunity to just try it out.
Yeah.
And see how how it goes.
You've mentioned something a couple times now that I want to kind of step back and kind of dive into a little bit more. The biopsychosocial model.
Yes, yes.
I've seen it just in talking to your friend Jim Stark. He's
yeah.
mentioned that as well. I'm not that familiar. Can you
shoot
for kind of a couple paragraphs? What is it and how
yeah.
does it work?
So the predominant way that we function in healthcare in... not just Western, but actually Eastern. It's sometimes the confusion is people think this is just a Western thing, but truthfully, even Meridian concepts and many of the Eastern concepts are pretty much biomedical. They're just another system that's
okay. yeah.
developed. But
yeah.
the biomedical model is what most people have essentially adhered to, because it was a simple way of teaching and compartmentalizing things. It is kind of essentially this disease-driven model.
Differential diagnosis model.
You got it, exactly.
Right?
And so,
patient comes in, low back pain, I try to figure it
fit
out.
Fit them in a box and...
Is it a muscle strain? Is it a facet problem? Is it a stenosis problem? Is it... what? I mean, you kind of do all your special tests and you divvy it down to, oh, okay, we have a stenosis problem, you know, or it's a hamstring problem, whatever the case might be, you know, it's right. You
exactly.
are this problem, then I treat it this way. Okay, biomechanical model.
You got it, exactly.
Okay.
That's
okay.
spot on. That's exactly
okay.
right. And so it is particularly when you think about things like emergency medicine, very valuable.
Yes, it is.
and decision-making in certain circumstances is very valuable. But it has become evident its flaws in that we are dealing with an epidemic of pain, which mm-hmm. we have 31% of Americans are dealing with some sort of persistent pain.
31%.
So wow. over a quarter of Americans have.
Be prepared to be busy.
that's exactly the idea here is that realizing that I think it's underrecognized, and so many of the patients, again, like I said, even cases where I think I did well and may or may not have done as well as I thought I did. Mm-hmm. I underappreciated some of these layers that we are limited with the biomedical model. Mm-hmm. So the biopsychosocial model is that essentially the bio is still the biomedical things that are important. Mm-hmm. I would kind of argue that we do spend a little bit more time actually critically looking at some of those things, because, you know, if you really critically look at the biomechanics literature, mm-hmm. all of a sudden you really become concerned that we don't know anything. And at that point in time, you start to realize, well, how does anything work and why does anything work? Mm-hmm. When you really delve into those things, you start to question. Mm-hmm. Now, those things are still, you know, when we identifying red flags, when we're looking at some general concepts of biomechanics that still are sustainable. Some concepts of, again, the musculoskeletal system, cardiovascular system, mm-hmm. neurologic system, all the physiology, a lot of those things, those are things that we need to know well and consistently are a part of the picture.
Yeah. Okay.
However, at the same time, we're looking at the psychological. So we're looking at, what is the individual thinking? What are they feeling? What is their, you know, what is their overall mental health at this time?
Okay.
When we think about something as simple as posture, or we think something as simple as an exercise we might prescribe to a person, we tend to think those things happen in isolation.
Yes, we do.
And the reality is that what that person is thinking, what the person is feeling is far more determinant of what the muscular behavior is going to be in that exercise, in that activity, in that posture, in those behaviors. Mm-hmm. How we hold ourselves, and even a lot of our posture beliefs, are also cultural, and I'll talk about that in a moment. They're more socially derived than they are scientifically derived as a whole. Mm-hmm. And so we have the individual and their overall thinking, their feeling, their cognitions, mm-hmm. that interplays with how we move, how the physiology of our body, the chemistry, stress, chemicals, adrenaline, cortisol, mm-hmm. You look at immune responses, all those kind of things are influenced mm-hmm. by, again, the psychological piece of it. Socially, we have all aspects of work, of family, of expectations, societal, cultural, all the individuals, you know, what the ethnic background, if they're in subsets of groups where there are certain expectations and beliefs. And so these are things that are present in every single person that we see. Yet so often we kind of hone in on one little thing that is profoundly influenced by this bigger picture as a whole there. Mm-hmm. So things like so I worked with April Gamble. She is a physical therapist who is in Iraq, and she works with victims of torture. Okay. And so we talked a little bit about this. I talked about, you know, how we have become this upright posture, which seems to be in somewhat... It's something that really developed around the 1920s, probably. It was not something that was a part of really Western culture as much as it almost is related to the whole kind of the country's kind of militarization, being upright, being confident. A lot of these things are derived from that concept.
Really?
Whereas in other countries, even now, being upright and sitting tall in a position can be a form of torture. It can be a form of sitting upright or standing upright, and being in this alert position could be something that could be used as a torture tool. Whereas we're considering it, oh, this is good posture.
Right, yeah. Grandma told me to stand straight.
Yeah, exactly. And so we have to realize that even has been influenced, because the biomechanics literature doesn't go one way or the other than change is important, you know, changing mm-hmm. our positions, changing our postures, mm-hmm. That is the key piece. So when we use this model and we use it on a person-first basis, what we're doing is we're looking at, okay, one thing is are they holding themselves in these rigid positions because they were taught to do so to help them with pain, but in turn, actually what's happening is that they are straining constantly, and they are having discomfort, and it's actually contributing to their pain. What's going on in their life, and how do they carry themselves with their families, and what's their ability to move? How much time do they have in the day? How much, how much does their work permit? What's the relationship between their boss and them? And how does that affect recovery from injury? And how does that affect recovery from pain? Which are two distinct things, but both can have complications with those interactions there.
Do you have an example, like from a successful patient that you helped walk through, and those three pieces came together?
Yeah, absolutely. I just gave one to PT in Motion recently. I don't know if I want to duplicate that one or not.
Right.
So I'll actually take an athlete. So before,
okay.
So individual. Final phase of their athletic career at this point in time, and had been struggling with multiple seasons. I'd worked with them with pain around the end of the season. Imaging special testing are very imaging was unremarkable.
Okay.
When you do your testing for orthopedic testing, very broad and very inconsistent, and not by of anything other than they're just globally.
Nothing's coming to the forefront.
You got it, Okay. Exactly. Multiple therapy, multiple individuals worked with this person. And as we started to kind of delve into it, we started to realize that around this time and at different periods of times, there was some degradation between the athlete and their coach. There was a huge social piece that started to be there. There started to be some expectations with family and with friends that were starting to influence how it was. So the stresses were higher. Sleep was less. The quality of sleep was poor, which again means recovery is worse.
Yeah, cortisol stays high.
You got it, exactly. Yeah. Performance is affected because their head is starting to can't be in the game. And so you have all of these factors going on in their life in addition to how those things are affecting the physiology. And you have this human alarm system, 45 miles of continuous wire, that is doused with sensitizing chemicals, again, cortisol, adrenaline, and any minor injuries, even if they could recover very quick for them, are not going to be recovering well and are going to be excruciatingly painful. And as so you are setting up the stage, and no matter what kind of manual therapy or what kind of piece you're going to give, if you cannot globally calm down that nervous system, you're not going to have any success.
So in other words, you're trying to shut off the alarm bell.
You got it, exactly.
Okay.
Get it to calm down. It will respond better to movement and to calming techniques and hands-on techniques and things like that if you can provide things like, one is just having them recognize all the stressors. Two is find outlets, whether it's having friends or family or potentially counseling if you can convince them, which is, for some individuals, it's a lot easier to get them to talk to someone who's a professional and talking to them. For others, you can't, and you almost have to be that. You have to be that third person, and that's where there's a huge area for essentially these third space or psychologically informed physical therapists, because we can't get them quite to the point of where they could get some assistance to help calm the nervous system down.
We are not trained in that.
it is something where we all have to go. I mean, as Jim has mentioned, we have to go out, we have to seek this education. We have to go to continuing education from psychology. We have to buy books. We have to get mentors.
Yes, absolutely.
And there are more physical therapists that are standing up in those roles too as mentors of how do you do this and implement it. There's still clear boundaries and things where you can't deal with this alone.
Sure. Yeah.
But there are so many people in, depression, anxiety, again, are such a large part of the modern society because of just how we, as humans have not quite kept up to the advancements in stressors we're dealing with. And so just being able to meet them and be able to be at least, at the very least, somewhere in the middle, that there's the physical therapist at one end, the psychologist at the other end, and then these people who are in the middle, these third space individuals who can kind of at least bridge the gap, and be able to help to meet them at that point. So
the athlete, were you able to help identify those stressors with him or her then?
Yes, correct. And so we were able to kind of get that in, and they had hints of that up to this point, and recognizing it was. The timing was not ideal. So this was not one of those cases where we had this wonderful outcome compared to some of the others. But the recognition, I think, set the stage for the post-career process, which was the key, was the recognition that what contributed to this end of the career challenge, they started to very deeply recognize that this was multifactorial. It was not just an injury, which they now knew after multiple imaging, multiple tests, and multiple procedures, didn't respond to. So it helped them to internalize and make sense of that and have an idea of how we're going to, in the long term, bring the alarm system down with both with dealing with some of the stressors, improving on sleep, working on essentially pacing the day, and they're a highly motivated individual as well. You need to make sure that they understand how do they develop self-care strategies to be able to take care of their lives and calm the system down and build it up, as well as how do they now get back into movement, because they still want to be active in their sport to some degree.
Sure.
Who knows where that's going to go.
Right.
And how do we start to support that and build the system up so they can start to be reconditioned and return to those activities? If they were to return to the sport the following year, now with the ground level laid, we can, and I have worked with athletes in the past where we were able to, over a year, build up and have them be ready, both physically, mentally, and emotionally, for competition again. And it requires, again, a different level of thinking and a different perspective of building up across time, because it's not quick.
Now, did you learn that at that Pain Institute? Spine?
It was part of it, but they only can provide you a very small foundation, which all of us are, as a result, have a responsibility to continue to to seek these things out.
And okay.
So a lot of how we've learned is, one is we sought out individuals who are in psychology. And we've also gone to individuals. Peter O'Sullivan is a great example. He's developed a system he calls cognitive functional therapy. And he has published some very good, kind of essentially like white paper rundowns of decision making and the concepts behind it. Kieran, I'm not even gonna try to pronounce his name right now. I feel bad.
That's all right.
But he,
we'll put him in the show notes.
I think he will be in Chicago soon. He will also be teaching a cognitive functional therapy module, and I think those kind of courses are helpful.
Are those for psychologists or physical
therapists?
Or both?
Physical therapists, because they actually have to do with primarily how rehabilitation professionals integrate these concepts.
So it's kind of
bridging the gap. There are many books on things, whether it's cognitive behavioral therapy, or my preferences of approaches through something called acceptance and commitment therapy. And so there are many introduction books, almost like books for dummies, things that are available, that are written for non-psychologists as well as psychologists to be able to make changes. Motivational interviewing is something that was actually introduced in my DPT program. There's a little bit of it, but none of us made any sense of it or had any idea what we could do with it or that it was important.
Nor was it probably, you probably didn't even learn more of it from your CIs because they didn't know how to do
exactly.
it, right? So then it was kind of like, oh, that's great, but I don't know how to use it, you know?
You got it, exactly. And so taking additional courses on that online and watching case examples online, and so you can learn a lot. We're in a whole new world of knowledge where we can not only read, but we can watch case examples. We can access videos with real live patients, and we can see how clinicians interact and learn.
Sure. Yeah.
Because there's so much you can learn sometimes just to actually watch a clinician do that is skilled in this avenue. And the little subtle things, and we talked a little bit briefly earlier about, just the laptop being to the side.
Yes.
How do you create that therapeutic space?
Yeah.
And so it's there's so many things to be learned sometimes visually and in person. And to skip a little bit ahead, that's part of what I'd like to be able to offer in my clinic is the opportunity for individuals to come in, observe, get an idea.
Oh, okay.
Cause
sure.
It makes a huge difference. Once you see it in action, it's like, oh, that, I get it now.
Well, I can think of so many examples in my career where, you know, you do everything you can. You think it's a tightness, so you do your manual therapy, you do your massage, you teach them the proper posture and body mechanics, and they just didn't get better.
Yeah.
And it's probably one of the most frustrating things I've experienced in life, because you are this professional. You've been taught that if you do A, B, and C for this patient, they should get better. And they never talk to you about what other options are there, you know? So this sounds like the 20% of the patients that I was unable to help. Maybe I'm being generous myself, but I didn't dig far enough in. There's two pieces that I was missing, the social piece and the psychological piece. I didn't even
think about it at the time.
Didn't even think about it at the time.
Same here. that is for sure. I look back at even some things that I've written and published in the past. I'm like, huh, yeah.
So okay. The cognitive functioning.
Yep. Cognitive functional therapy. Yep. CFT.
Is that based on the biopsychosocial model?
Correct, yes.
And it teaches you motivational interviewing.
It teaches you a broad level of skills. So they have a number of things that are available there. And so they have done some pieces. There are a number. It would be hard pressed for me to get all of the individuals who have put together some resources.
Yeah.
The other thing too is it's what helps me as a clinician to grow is the diversity of courses and individuals that I observe. And
sure.
You have to develop your own style and mm-hmm. sometimes there's some really good information, but you're not really kind of meshing with that model or that approach, and you can take a lot of pieces from it, but then this one you can take a lot from. And so I think, as is always the case, you know, you look at OMT, you look at all sorts of orthopedic manual approaches, mm-hmm. there are all these different schools and models, and
yes, there are.
And so as I've gone along, I've recognized that there are some things that I do that's a little bit differently. It's, you know, mm-hmm. I started to piece together these things and just where it's come about for clinical practice, and I wanted to start to share that. And
mm-hmm.
so, you know, my first experiment was again starting up the pain division and
yep.
having
yep.
courses and lectures through that process and mentorship, and mm-hmm. It's just continued to evolve. And and this year it's been great. Last year was the first year where we were able to start deploying some of these 2-day courses and realizing, oh, we need a third and a fourth day.
Is that the dynamic recovery you're talking about?
Exactly. Cool. So I realized, okay, we need a little bit more because there's so much to try and fill in this so many gaps to fill. And then this year was able to actually bring on Jim Stark. And Jim is created a number of courses in the third space realm, which has been really helpful because, again, that's a layer and a piece that I touch on, but I cannot spend the time. And I would teach it differently than him, and I would like to, in my own kind of new mm-hmm. programming, to have that very dedicated piece there.
Yeah, cool.
Michelle Morrow is another physical therapist, actually one of my classmates.
We've
both been kind of gone through this different journey as a process. And she has some unique takes as well through her experience on essentially helping with building up a patient with persistent pain. And again, the idea is it's not just about the physical aspects. It's dealing with resiliency, dealing with motivation, dealing with these pieces. So they both offer some avenues of I have this broad overview, a little bit more what people are familiar with kind of lab-centric kind of manual and assessment and all these mm-hmm. kind of pieces. But then we have these other lecture pieces as well. As David Schwartz is is my third instructor who has a history with massage therapy.
Okay.
And so we're trying to also integrate some, because there's so many essentially orthopedic programs that emphasize mostly joint-based. Mm-hmm. And so soft tissue has always been a big part of my learning process. And mm-hmm. and I thought, well, you know what? A better person to do this would be a licensed massage therapist.
There you go.
I have my history. And yeah. I'm very confident, but I think it's better off to
there you
have,
go. Yeah.
have a skilled massage therapist who understands this. So I'm very proud of how this year we've got a diverse team instead of just me thinking things, but at the same time we're all very much on the same boat trying to help people.
So there's three courses you guys offer now?
So we actually have dynamic principles original courses and the primary one is pain science movement and manual therapy. There's an overview course which is a 2-day course just to introduce okay. the concepts and it's hard to even in those 2 days to just introduce it. Then there's upper quarter and a lower quarter, and the upper and quarter and lower quarter are entirely lab based. So we literally will have some handouts that review. I'll throw some things on the screen, but it is, roughly 2 hours per region, ankle, knee, hip, where we talk about not just how do we integrate and kind of look at biomechanics, looking from joint, from arthrokinematics to osteokinematics to fascial chains to neurodynamics, and how do we make this a lot simpler?
Okay.
And realize that it truly needs to be simpler because there's so little that makes sense if you didn't make it simple.
Okay.
But at the same time, the concept of this and even what everyone else is teaching is this idea of being mm-hmm. confident with ambiguity. Which is this idea that
we hate ambiguity in science.
Exactly, we do. Which is we have to learn to accept that there is uncertainty.
Wow. Okay. That's revolutionary right there. That's awesome. But relieving at the same time.
It is, and you have to. You can't be lost. You can't be completely like, well, we just don't know. Yes, we don't know, but we can have some confidence based on all these different pieces. We can kind of move forward, and we can help keep it together for the patient and for ourselves.
And it's not a guess; it's an informed decision, right?
It's a very, very informed,
right? Yeah. But it's not this. It's going to be the subtalar joint is tight.
Exactly. Yeah. You know? It's just not.
It's not that simple.
Exactly. It's just not that. And so when you are giving this ankle pain. And you realize you cannot just say it's just that, but then how are you going to move forward confidently with a plan, stay on a schedule to keep the patient on board and to mm-hmm. keep them motivated? That again, that's that skill, that confident ambiguity.
That's sweet. And those courses are available on the website,
Dynamic Principles?
Correct. Okay.
Dynamicprinciples.com, yeah.
Okay.
So
and I think I saw them this year, right?
Yes.
Oh, cool.
Yep, so I've got them going this year and... most of them are going to be here at the clinic, so it just makes it a lot more convenient, and we'll have everything available. But the past we've done them, and we do go out, and if someone wants to host, we gladly will figure out how to schedule it.
Sure. Cool.
And it's been kind of a fun.
What a courageous thing you guys are doing! So needed because it. It's really not addressed in physical therapy school. I mean, you mentioned motivational interviewing, but is the biopsychosocial model kind of even introduced?
The term is mentioned. It was when I was there, but then I've had the other students who said they don't remember hearing it. Perhaps I'm imagining it. There's a chance. It's mentioned, but there's no use of how do you make sense of it? It's not integrated into it. And again, it could also depend each semester what the professor might have introduced versus they didn't keep it.
There's so much to get in there, but I think that would be so key because that would capture so many of our patients that are dealing with chronic pain. I mean,
absolutely.
Tissues heal in 4 to 6 months, right?
So yeah, there's got to be that. Who are we seeing? Most of the time we're seeing them after that.
6 years, okay. Yeah. I immediately began to think, I don't know if I'm going to help. And then I'm projecting what I'm thinking.
And that affects the outcome.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, oh, gosh.
I don't think I can help, therefore probably can't.
I wanted to ask a little bit about, so you started this clinic, right? Mm-hmm. Who are you, who's your niche? Who's your target audience for this clinic? I mean, mm-hmm. the more niche you are, they always say you're better you are. So...
That's a good question.
Well, I mean, just the general person, obviously, but I mean, Are you targeting people with that have been dealing with pain for a while, or
that is, I would say, the large portion of who I would, you know, I hesitate to say target, but I feel like that's what I need to be here for, is people who have had long standing pain. Just because we, you know, again, some of my former colleagues that went through some of the stuff that I've taught and have expanded their own way, are obviously also available in the community now, but my job is to continue to be more available for those that have been struggling for a while. Mm-hmm. But I think it's going to evolve and it's going to change. You know, I'm in a much different physical location. It's much more accessible. It's visible. I have different, you know, I have different organizations and individuals that are looking at what I'm doing. The International Olympic Committee has really made a statement a few years ago about that, you know, sports medicine professionals need to be using a biopsychosocial model. Same thing with the NCAA, same thing with the U.S. military. So I think that sports medicine is going to evolve, and I've worked a little bit with Grand Valley's sports medicine team as well. We're doing some educational material for athletes in the future. And so I think that it may evolve a little bit where, you know, there may be a little bit return to sports medicine, but using the biopsychosocial lens.
Yeah.
And it's just because I just want to help to lay that groundwork. I still really enjoy working with people who, you know, just have been struggling and just want to be able to, whether it's clean their house or go there. But there's a real joy to being able to expand this so that we are seeing this for everyone as a whole. And I think that means that, again, even as I hire individuals and as I build a clinic and, you know, we've got a 5-year lease here, it helps me to think to where we're going to go, you know, at the next phase. Are we able to work in this space, or are we going to be going to a larger facility and supporting, again, kind of a broader group of anyone who's struggling in pain across multiple levels of functioning, whether it be just basically trying to get through life to high level elite performance, which, again, I think that we're starting to get to the point of where we realize that performance enhancement and recovery are very much overlap. And to look at how do we manage stressors, and we're seeing a lot more play in I'm seeing more and more in the news, there's more and more recognition of it, but we still have a ways to go, because again, the old mindset is, you know, if it isn't injured, suck it up, and that doesn't work. and not recognizing how much stress these athletes, especially at elite level, are going through. You know,
not only physical stress, but performance stress.
It's performance
for themselves, for family, for their friends, their peers, their competition. It's like
coach. Oh, it's huge.
Yeah.
It's
loads of stress.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's not always addressed. You know, there are, they at least have connections with performance psychologists, but not, I don't think they all take advantage of what's available to them, because there is, again, a cultural denial. And so the more we can make people comfortable with realizing that, doesn't matter what level you're at, this is something that can help you to both, again, recover, but also improve your performance and your function, to look at the whole person and all of life and what can you do to, you know, move forward from there. So
I often say this, and I keep coming back to it. It's like, we got into physical therapy because we wanted to help people. I mean, also, you love learning about the body, right? That was awesome. But you're like, what am I going to do with that? Well, I get to help people, right? And so I just think that this way of thinking about delivering physical therapy care just opens doors to be able to help more people.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's the athlete or whether it's the mom that just wants to be able to reach down, pick up their 1-year-old and not have neck pain.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's just across the board. It'd be super cool, you know, to open more doors to help people. And I think you're really, it's a great thing you guys are trying to develop here. It's really cool. I had one more question for you. So you had this dream of starting this clinic. I've heard so many people talk about the dream of starting their own physical therapy clinic. Just talk about the hurdles you had to overcome, the leap of faith you had to take, whatever it cost. Can you just kind of talk about that whole journey of when that start and how long did it take? And
sure.
Yeah.
Again, just like I didn't take a very traditional approach to this process. I knew that I would be a part of developing something. That okay. I always knew. Always knew I'd be part of that. I kind of assumed that I would do it with someone else or with another company.
You basically started out with Generous Care a little bit. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And it was perfect. The challenge for both of us was just that my projects and my other companies, it got bigger than what could be done in that kind of environment.
Sure, yeah.
And so I think when that realization hit, I think it was really just a year ago that I really realized that the only way for me to be able to fully do all the things, deliver all the services that I want to do, and have the flexibility to do without harming someone else's business potentially, is I have to go on my own.
Okay.
And that's what it came down to was essentially it was all these things and opportunities kept growing and kept growing and kept growing. And I think I was again a little bit in denial. Okay. So I always seem to be the last person to
know. Not me. I can't do that.
Exactly. And I think so many people knew that I would be a physical therapy practice owner before me.
Okay.
And I'm like, I'll be glad to be a part of some director role or something like that, but that's not me. And it just kind of, again, just like the before, it just was a sudden like, nope, this is what I gotta do.
Okay.
And it was time to, move on. And so the process of starting a practice when you didn't fully plan for it is probably a little bit harder. But I've had some good mentorship. I've had just a lot of former physical therapists that I work with. There was a recent physical therapist, Tom Trumbull, out of Grand Haven. He had started a place, and I was able to kind of get, since it was still fresh in his head, trying to see what were some of the things that he could pass on, learning wise from that process. And you just kind of, to some degree, you just try and fill out the paperwork and you do your process and you try and present your case, whether it's for financing or whether it's for the insurance accreditation, which is always a ongoing process and still is.
Yeah.
It's little successes that add up to the point of where I'm starting to feel like, wow, this is really real, and here's the building, and now
it is real. It's really nice looking too. Real too.
It's turned out
beautiful
really well.
Facility.
I'm very That's very cool. pleased with it. I'm very pleased with it.
And so it was about a year long process.
Yeah.
When did you stop working?
It was a lot less than that. Technically, it was. Okay. It's been about 6.5 months.
Oh, okay.
But it was. I had the I've been trying to work with just trying to see is there any way that I could make sense of what I'm trying to do and make sure that it doesn't interfere with the needs of their company or it just wasn't going to work. And so I think right until the end where essentially was like, nope. And that was where it essentially, I gotta hit the ground running. I did not have a good plan up until that point because I was still again in denial that this is what I'm gonna do. I still thought, maybe this is going to work, but it was one of those things where I literally had 6.5 months to kind of.
So did you quit it 6.5 months ago then?
It was, we mutually separated. We just realized it was not going to be a good, it wasn't going to work anymore.
Right. So then it's like, boom, I got to get this rolling because I need to start making money.
You got it. Exactly. And so, so as soon as we separated and, I had to, I had to learn a lot. And at the same time, I had patients who were trying to track me down. And so you're trying to kind of keep your head on because you're like, I have so much to learn. I don't know if I really can practice right now, but you still want to kind of keep your foot in the game. So I was fortunate. I was able to get a temporary spot within a week and was able to help, do a little bit of cash base. And so I kept doing cash base, very small amounts of, there'd be ebbs and flows where I'd like kind of go a little heavier where it was slower time, but then cut it back down, but was able to keep practicing while still trying to just Figure out financing, figure out how do you build a space. I mean, I had no experience building an interior space, designing it, and was really surprised when I finally designed it in this kind of consumer software that the final drawings, they're like, yep, that's pretty good. I was like thinking they would have to redo all these things, and they had to move things a couple of feet here and there, and but just, you know, learning how to put together the space and learning how to prioritize and going through all these different loops of you know, as a small business owner, your financing options are fairly limited. We were very fortunate to partner with Choice One and have a good opportunity there, because honestly, you have a better opportunity getting a restaurant finance than a physical therapy clinic.
Wow, those fail quite regularly.
Yeah.
Oh my.
And so
I did not realize that.
It is not easy, especially again when you're. I didn't have this set plan. It was sort of like I had to figure out how do I make things work. And my wonderful wife is able to, obviously, we were able to kind of adjust our finances and make ends meet with one income during that time. And you just kind of hammer forward until it actually comes into fruition in a very short amount of time.
Courageous, that's all I can say. And
just, or stupid.
And lots of perseverance, I'm sure. Yeah. And just, what do you mean that's not accepted? Why can't I do that?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I want to thank you for your time, Leonard.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having
and
me.
And I'm sure we could talk more future about the biopsychosocial model and about what you're doing in your classes. I'd love to come back sometime and talk about that. But how can people get a hold of you here and on the web? Give them all your details.
What absolutely. So, Dynamic Principles for the Education Company, just www.dynamicprinciples.com. I can look us up there. The clinic, DMR, Dynamic Movement and Recovery, just dmrmove.com.
Okay.
And there's contact forms on there, but otherwise, info@dynamicprinciples.com or info@dmrmove will get them to me, and you can find me on Twitter, LinkedIn, wherever Facebook
reaches you.
You got it, exactly.
So. And this is 4905 East, Northeast Plainfield?
Northeast Plainfield, Suite A.
Yeah. And this is actually, is this, what's the city or?
This is Grand Rapids.
Grand Rapids. Okay. So, I didn't know if we were.
Yeah, I thought too, I wasn't sure, was this Plainfield?
Yeah,
was
right.
I wasn't sure, but no, the zip code ended up being Grand Rapids proper. So.
Cool, good. Yeah. Well, thanks again for your time.
Thank you
appreciate
so much.
Appreciate it. Yeah, and I'm sure we'll be talking again.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah.